Hi, everybody. Welcome to episode 18 of Mic Check on Sports. I'm Steve Napolitani. The sports world is hopefully making some progress. There are sources saying that Major League Baseball could start around July 1st, and it sounds like an all-NBA player call is about to happen as well. In my continuing effort to support small businesses during this time, I'd like to dedicate this episode to a couple of our favorite spots for wings in Buffalo, New York, Gabriel's Gate and the Bada Bing Sports Bar. Look forward to getting back to those places soon. My next guest has called everything from Russian hockey to minor league baseball in Montana. He's the radio voice of the New York Knicks. And most importantly, he is now a father for the first time. It's Ed Cohen. Ed, how are you?
Hey, Steve. Great to be with you, man. I've listened to a lot of your podcasts already. You've had awesome guests. They're terrific. And I'm just honored to join you. Thank you.
Well, thanks for coming on and congratulations being a father for the first time. How you doing? That's obviously occupying your time, I'm sure.
Just a little bit, right? No, yeah. It's unique, but my wife gave birth to Benjamin Miles, April 9th, 7:29 in the morning. You know, everyone was saying leading up to it, it's not like the movies. You'll have time, you'll get to the hospital. It doesn't happen right away. This was close to the movies. It was quick. You know, we had that drive in the middle of the night where we had to get there quickly, and but we're grateful. He keeps us up, but I think one of the silver linings of this whole pandemic and what everybody's going through is we get to spend a lot of time at home with him, and you know, for that we're grateful for every minute.
Well, they say there's a silver lining in everything, so that is awesome.
Yes.
So you grew up in Scarsdale, New York. What was life like growing up there? You know, where did your love of sports come from?
You know, it was a great place to grow up. Great schools, teachers, friends, all of that. You know, I'd love to say I was a really good athlete and I was close to making a number of high school teams. I was not. I had a nice jump shot. I was more of an inquisitive mind. You know, when I played rec baseball growing up, I was the one who, you know, if I drew a walk, maybe had a single and got to first base, I would speak to the first base coach. Or if I was playing first, I would, you know, have that conversation that you'd watch on television between major leaguers. Mm-hmm. I saw the nuances of the game, if you will. I'd say to justify my playing career, I used to go to summer camp at Camp Greylock in the Berkshires in Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. And they used to put together, the counselors did, teams for the color competition, red and gray, which was, you know, so intense, you know, when you're 13, 14 years old. I mean, it was, you wait the entire summer for those 4 days. But I think somebody had a quote, they said, when making football teams, Ed Cohen's the best center in camp, but once he snaps the ball, he might as well walk off the field. That, in a nutshell, was my playing career. But I always had a love for sports, and I never felt restricted to one or two. I loved everything. And when I was in fifth grade in elementary school, we had to take part in a writing contest in fifth grade, which was your final step in basically moving on to middle school in sixth grade. And the question that we had to write about that was posed was, what do you most look forward to doing when you grow up? And most kids said, going to college or learning to drive. And I wrote, I can't wait to be a sportscaster in New York, something along the lines of calling the final out of the Yankees winning the World Series. This was 1994. So little did we know there'd be plenty of that in the years to come, but it always felt natural to me. And then when I got to high school, it was something I had said that I'd always wanted to do, but you know what it's like at that stage of your life. You can say things, we actually take the initiative. And the beauty of growing up in Scarsdale was we had a public access television station, and you'd watch school board meetings, those types of programs. But occasionally they would show a high school basketball game or a baseball game featuring Scarsdale and another team. And I finally had the guts, the wherewithal to go down to the basement floor in Scarsdale High. And Dave Berry was the man who was running it at the time, and volunteer as a sophomore. And that was my first real experience on the air. I also wrote a lot in high school. I was the sports editor of the school newspaper, The Maroon, mm-hmm. which was a terrific experience. So that was it for me. It was just a great place to grow up in the sense that the opportunities were there if you wanted them.
And then you had the opportunity to go to Bruce Beck sportscasting camp, which I believe was the Bruce Beck and Ian Eagle camp at the same time at that time.
You know what? They started that, I believe, in 2002. But mm-hmm. for me, I actually started working for Bruce. I never went as a camper, but I began working for Bruce my senior year of high school. So it was 2000, and which is unbelievable to think. It's more than half of my life. And he had placed an ad in the Scarsdale Youth Employment Office. And my mom at the time was actually a volunteer. She would go there once a week. There weren't a lot of highly attractive jobs. It was mostly babysitting or an odd job around town. But sure enough, the last day she was volunteering, so this is the fall of 2000, she comes across an ad from Bruce that says, looking for a local student as an assistant who could volunteer 2 to 4 hours a day, 3 days a week, whatever it may be. Sports research, help with shows, preparation, unbelievable stuff. Also asking for a valid driver's license, ability to help run some errands in the community. So it encompassed everything. But it was basically a chance to learn and work with somebody who had been in the business for 30 years. Right. And you know, little did I know then it would be a 20-year mentorship, friendship. You know, Bruce was my host for what we had called Senior Options. It was a program at Scarsdale High School. So that summer, or excuse me, that spring, I was tagging along to when the Devils were playing for the Stanley Cup in 2001. The Jets had a media day in which Herm Edwards gathered the writers in a film room and was explaining the various gaps on the line and how they coach their players. And I'm 17, and Bruce is walking me right into these real-world situations. So I interned with NBC. He's heard the best and the worst of my career. He's listened to many long conversations over the years, and I could confidently say, I mean, I would not be in this spot without him, that's for sure.
And is there any other sportscasters that you kind of looked up to as a kid, as you followed the games?
Oh, for sure. You mentioned Ian. Ian Eagle, on a personal level, has been just an amazing mentor and a real career inspiration. Mike Breen, ditto for that, especially now covering the Knicks. Mike has just been such a great influence. I'd say growing up, I listened to plenty of Marv, and it's obviously something that really resonates now with The Last Dance and watching the national telecast of Jordan against those Knicks teams. Right. I always felt, you know, Al Michaels, his ability to punctuate big plays and tell the story, he might be the best that's ever done it. And a lot of guys, Steve, who I think many people forget were such, you know, key voices in the 90s, like John Miller on Sunday Night Baseball, Gary Thorne, and later Doc on the Cup Finals. So those are a few who I think early on especially really influenced me and helped me in terms of, you know, laying down that foundation as a kid that you only hope to establish when you step into the business.
And you talk about Marv Albert, about The Last Dance. You know, I find myself, even though he's still doing it, there's something so special watching it and hear him say like Jordan and Pippen and those names coming out of this, right? It's like, it's just kind of what you said is kind of what the other night I'm watching it and thinking this, the same exact thing. It sounded so good to hear him say those names again.
Oh, without a doubt. Those NBA on NBC telecasts between Jim Fagan's voice, they'd cut to the aerial shot of whatever arena it was, and they toss it down to Bob Costas, who's throwing it to Marv and Bill Walton and Matt Gukas. I mean, it felt massive. You know, forget about Jordan, those Knicks teams, the 90s NBA. those voices just took it to a whole nother level.
Mm-hmm. And then obviously you have a relationship with Bruce Beck, an Ithaca alumni like yourself. Did Bruce push you in that direction?
It's funny. I'm sure at the time he may have been an inspiration as a successful alum. Mm-hmm. I had actually visited, so this is the fall of 2000. I was a senior in high school. I went to Syracuse on a Monday, and then I drove down with my father and visited Ithaca on a Tuesday. And I fell in love with the campus and what it was all about. So this was early in the fall, and I applied early. I didn't get in, I was deferred. So I eventually did get in, but I applied in November, and I think I answered that ad from Bruce around Thanksgiving. So I had already decided to go a month or so before I had really met him and gotten to know him. So it was a coincidence, but I'm sure at the time, if you asked me as a 17-year-old why Ithaca, Bruce was probably one of the big reasons why.
And then you graduated in 2005, and I, you know, heard your first gig was Manhattan College basketball. Talk about what you learned from that experience.
You know, it was the perfect place for that first job. And I know you can relate to this and so many others as well. The first job in many ways can be the hardest, but it's the most memorable. I mean, you could retrace your steps because you're soaking everything in and learning on the fly. And that for me was that job with Manhattan. It's a really unique place. And I say that in the most sentimental of ways. I mean, it's Manhattan College. It's located in the Bronx. The team is named the Jaspers after Brother Jasper, who history says supposedly invented the seventh inning stretch in the 1800s. I mean, the school has a great story. And I remember I had made a list coming out of school. It was my goal, I guess, at the time to land a Division I radio play-by-play job in the New York area. At least that was my first attempt at getting on the air. And I wrote a list of really every mid-major school within a two-hour radius. So I called Marist, you know, and I spoke to their SID for maybe 5 seconds. And he said, "We have our guys." And I did that for everybody. And I connected with Mike Antonaccio, who is the SID at the time and a good friend still to this day at Manhattan. And it might have been sheer timing or luck, whatever it was. And he said, "We might have an opening, send us a CD." And I think I called him every day or every week for the next 2 months without being overly annoying. And sure enough, they had an opening. And the athletic director at the time, Bob Burns, hired me. This is a guy who gave Steve Lapis his first head coaching job. You know, he hired Fran Fraschilla, Bobby Gonzalez, Steve Masiello. And Bob's approach was, "I'm willing to give you your break as a coach, as a broadcaster, whatever. I want to see you grow here. And when it's time to leave, I will not hold anything against you. I'll be happy for your success and happy that it started here." And you don't forget those kinds of people.
Right. There's not many of those kinds of people.
There aren't. He was very hands off, but you always felt like you had his support. And it's funny, with the pandemic, it's given us more time to pick up the phone and maybe connect with people who we haven't spoken to in a while. I spoke to Bob a couple of weeks ago, which was just a really special conversation. And I'm just grateful to him and the coaches who I covered at the time, the people within the athletic department. It was a really cool place. If you can ever get up to a game there, Draddy Gym, it's not a conventional venue. It feels more like an airplane hangar than a college basketball arena. But I loved every minute there. I was there for 6 years, and I'm still grateful to this day that was the place that helped start my career.
Yeah, as a Marist alumni, Draddy Gymnasium is not a fond place for me. But and then, you know, you did other things. Rutgers women's basketball. You did minor league baseball in North Carolina. Another year you did it in 2008 in Billings, Montana. I mean, was it pretty much you're hiring, I'm going?
Yeah, I have to apologize to you and people in this spot. It can feel like navigating a roadmap and talking about every little job I've had over the years. So great research. There were a lot of stops. Mm-hmm. But I think for me, coming out of school, you know, I was lucky. The timing worked out to land that Manhattan job. I mean, I was so grateful at the time. If that doesn't happen, and it's December after graduating, I would have easily been willing to go anywhere in the country just to get the reps. Mm-hmm. You tell me the station and I'll be there. I think conversely, when you start in New York, you're not going to jump, say, to MSG or the NBA. Right. You have to take any opportunity that's given, not just on the air, but behind the scenes. I was a PA at WNBC for 2-3 years out in the field, conducting interviews, working on scripts, and that was all really beneficial. So with that said, when you build your resume and reputation in New York, you have to be willing to try anything. And at the time it felt daunting, but you know, versatility in this business is everything. Mm-hmm. And I think that certainly was my approach at the time, no question.
Then you spent some time Sirius Radio doing some updates and started working with One World Sports. You called KHL games, Champions Hockey League, Chinese basketball, the Yomiuri Giants in Tokyo. And all these games came in and you didn't travel. You took them off a feed for most of them. And first off, how much of a disadvantage is it for you to call a game off a monitor rather than be there?
You know, it's different, Steve. I think sadly, it's become something that I've, I won't say mastered, but I've gotten used to. Mm-hmm. I've done so much of it. We got into this business, I think you ask any sportscaster, certainly any play-by-play announcer, we got into it to be there, right? Mm-hmm. You never mm-hmm. forget what it was like as a kid or, you know, with your friends to go to a ball game, to go to a game at Madison Square Garden. And the thought that you could be on site for a living, home, away, wherever, that was the dream. So it's funny now that with the technology and the means to do games in the studio that there are those abilities. But with that said, I think you have to take it sport by sport. A game like basketball, you can see it really well off the monitor, but what if there's a foul? Do you know who it's on immediately? Will they give you on a world feed a cutaway of an official who's explaining what the foul is and who it's on? So those are some tricky areas, and you don't want to be definitive if you don't have all of the information. Baseball is another great example. Doing those Japanese games, you could hear a little roar from the crowd, and a guy takes a big swing, and the ball's in the air, and when they cut away from the center field camera, you think it's heading towards the fence. All of a sudden, it's behind second base. That could be really jarring. So I think it's just reps and experience. But for me, those experiences at One World were huge because I had called some hockey, but I'd never really done it consistently. And all of a sudden, you're calling games from Russia where you have to, number one, follow the puck, but master the pronunciations right. And really nail the basics. And the reps were just invaluable. I did a lot of the playoff games, especially with Tom Laidlaw, who, you know, former Ranger, yeah. Tommy Survivor, he was on, uh-huh. you know, CBS in the fall, yeah. and just a character, great guy, taught me so much about the game.
He's doing these Facebook Live shows now, too.
He's everywhere.
With Dave Maloney, I think Kenny Albert's joining him.
I did see Kenny on that. Yes. Yeah, Ron Greshner, all those guys. Yeah, Tom's awesome. He still lives in the area. So working with him at One World Sports, and I think another part of it that for me was a huge boost in my confidence, but just really, I think, helped me in the years before I took the Knicks job. Different sport, but we covered the New York Cosmos, and I was working with Shep Messing and Janosch Mihalik, and these are guys who've worked at a really high level calling soccer on top of what they accomplished as players. Mm-hmm. And Shep, you know, he was willing to pull me aside and say, hey, you said offsides, it's offside, man. You're doing great though. Keep it up. he made me feel so good and like I belonged. And I'd fill in for JP Della Camera, who is literally the voice of soccer in this country. And, you know, One World didn't last as long as I think we all would have wanted to. It folded in 2016, and the business may not have been sustainable, but I would put some of the work that we all did on the air and certainly behind the scenes, the productions, for what they were really solid. And I think for me as an announcer, were invaluable. I mean, it really helped me work on some of my play-by-play skills, calling sports that I hadn't really mastered yet. And I give them so much thanks for that. It really was a great experience.
And how do you prepare for those games? I mean, the preparation's got to be extra hard, right?
It is. I think for me, it was the basics first and foremost. I mean, you could only prepare so much for games that are coming from Russia or China or countries in Asia. We did a number of Asian Soccer League games. You just hope to get the names and numbers. You then hope to say, okay, here are the pronunciations, and I will not deviate from those. And then you really have to pay attention to what's happening on top of trying to dig research and work some of the storylines in. So it was a great challenge, but I think it sharpened my game calling skills, because you had to nail the basics and you couldn't fall behind and worry about throwing that nugget in when all of a sudden, you know, the puck's in the zone and they're about to score. I think that was huge. You know, I will say this, you know, those Russian hockey games, the pronunciations were tough. When there was a guy like Nigel Dawes playing for a team like Boris, if Dawes with the puck, Dawes across the line, Dawes, score. I mean, I would say his name about five times a play.
And then to continue on this roadmap of Ed Cohen, you've worked for CBS Sports Network, Big Ten Network, Atlantic 10 Network, call games that aired on SNY, American Sports Network. You know, you're calling the game, you're doing play-by-play, you're doing your own prep, but how challenging is it to work with different production crews? Because everybody kind of brings their own spin on it from the truck or in the control room sense.
That's a great question. And I think going in, you have to know everybody's style, command, demeanor is going to be different, but you can't be rigid when you're working for so many different people at so many different places. I think you have to say, and this is my approach, I'm going to be the best teammate possible. And you have to take things in stride. There might be a game in Philadelphia where you're working with somebody who covers a professional team regularly, and they've picked up a college game, and they've just been in these situations so many times, they're going to steer you the right way. Other times I called many games, college games for ESPN, CBS, where I would work with someone who was literally producing their first game. They had worked for CBS as a AD or a graphics assistant and had kind of climbed the ladder, and they were finally getting a crack on a game. Might have been a women's basketball game in the Atlantic 10. And I think from my perspective, I had to be the one who said, hey, you know, do your thing. I'll follow you. I think that's the best way to do it. You know, be a good teammate. Be somebody who makes them feel comfortable. So that's how I always approached it. You have to be yourself, but I think you have to be adaptable too.
Right. And then 2006, you got a chance to work for the Olympics and NBC.
Yeah.
How much of an honor is it to be part of the Olympic broadcasting team?
Like you wouldn't believe. I got the call in April for the August game. So they were in Rio 4 years ago. And I had never done or covered weightlifting before. I had covered so many other sports. And I think the tape that I had sent to NBC was of me doing rugby the spring before. And I remember when that came about, someone said, have you ever done rugby? And I said, no. And they said, well, they want someone with rugby experience. And I said, well, it has to be the first time for everybody. And it was a great lesson. You prepare as much as you possibly can to learn the sport, to get comfortable with the terminology and the energy that's required. And if you could do that, that's going to carry over into many sports, certainly many Olympic sports. So when they call with weightlifting, I say, great, I knew nothing about it. But it was an awesome experience. It was like we talked about earlier, Steve, off the monitor up at the NBC studios in Stamford. And where we were lucky is I worked with Shane Hammond, who is a former U.S. super heavyweight back in, I think, 2000 and maybe 96 in Atlanta. Just an awesome guy. We had a statistician named Harvey Newton, who had coached with the U.S. Olympic team, I think as recently as Seoul in 88, maybe further. But he had, after that point, worked on a number of the Olympic broadcasts. So he was an amazing resource. And I remember that July, I said to him, is there anything I can do to either see an event in person or talk to somebody who can help just get a sense of the flow of it all? And he found a CrossFit event in Brooklyn that July. It was an adult weightlifting competition, if you will. And I took the train out there. I think it was Franklin Avenue, went to this CrossFit, and it was a massive scene buried in the back of this, you know, huge space out in Brooklyn. And I was sitting with the official score as coaches and weightlifters changed weights and stepped up and took, you know, that next step in class, whatever it may be. And it solidified what it was going to be like calling it off a monitor from Brazil. So that was huge. I felt like I was five steps ahead. And I think that really helped. But when you're calling an event in which medals are being awarded, and I think the last day is when the women's super heavyweight, Sarah Robles, won bronze. It was the Americans' first medal, I think, in 12 or 16 years. And that was really, when she's stepping up to the podium and the American flag is there, that's a really special moment to be a part of.
That's awesome. Yeah, I've worked a handful, and I will say that the novelty of working in Olympics does not wear off.
No, for sure. And I think now, too, you know, I dream of one day covering an Olympic Games on site, but the direction it's going, there's so many sports, and we're more than capable as announcers, and I think as broadcast networks, of bringing a lot in-house. NBC did a great job of replicating as best as they could that experience even half a world away. So I give them a lot of credit. But one day, have you ever been on site for one, or has it been more remotely as well?
All on site except for one. So
I can't, I'm sure it's amazing, and I can't wait one day, hopefully, you know, to be in your shoes doing that.
And hopefully I'll be working with you when you're doing it. That would be awesome.
Thumbs up, man.
And then the summer of 2017, you break in with MSG Networks calling New York Liberty games. A few months later, you get the job as the Knicks radio voice. Having grown up down the street from the Knicks practice facility, which was in Purchase and then in Greenberg, you know, how big in your career was that position?
Wow. I'd say you realize when something like that opens, you're about to come full circle. You know, for me, growing up in the area, and, you know, full disclaimer, I went to more Nets games as a kid than I did Knicks games. There was something about Drazen Petrovic and the Jason Kidd teams later on. You know, it was really hard to get tickets to see the Knicks at Madison Square Garden. Nets games, you could sit five rows off the floor. But I love the NBA, and I would say there was a lot of jealousy in looking at the Knicks and their fan base and how passionate they are and will always be, even through the best of times and worst of times. I mean, the Knicks are the one team in New York where you just feel like if they won the championship again, the city would stop, taking nothing away from the other three major sports. But you do have Mets fans and Yankees fans. You have Jets fans and Giants fans. You have three hockey teams. No offense to the Nets, but the Knicks, if they were to ever win again, this city would stop in its tracks. And I think jobs like that don't open every day. And I think navigating this business, you say to yourself, who knows? It almost doesn't seem like a possibility. So when that job opened, I thought, well, I mean, coming out of school, it was my goal to call Division I basketball in New York on the radio just to start. But this would really feel full circle for me. And, you know, I had the great thing about MSG, and you know this as well as anyone, Steve, is people have been there a long time. And if they haven't been in their current positions, they've been part of something else. I first worked on a game that aired on MSG, I think in 2007. I filled in on a high school game of the week with Bob Lawani producing. and Mike Quick, who's another just great mentor of mine, Mike saw something in me to say, hey, we're going to give you a shot when there's an opportunity. And you go fast forward, I was lucky to work at MSG Varsity, and the guys in the crew in the truck, some analysts, they're at MSG now. And I always viewed the Garden as a place where all roads lead there. And I always felt the comfort level in working with the various folks at the network, at the other places I had mentioned. So when the Knicks job opened, and even before that, having a chance to do some Liberty games, it just felt right. It felt comfortable. And, you know, the Knicks job is something I could have only dreamed of, but being able to call everybody a teammate who's at MSG now, I mean, that to me is as big a part of it as anything. And I'm incredibly lucky to say I'm one of many who's a part of this great network. That's for sure.
I agree. And, you know, being mainly a radio guy, but you do get a chance to be on the TV side and call play-by-play. When you're sitting there next to Walt Clyde Frazier calling the Knicks games, do you ever pause for a moment and think about what you're doing?
The first game I filled in for Mike and Kenny with Clyde was in Phoenix, my first year with the Knicks. Steve, it was as if I had never done a game in any sport. I was so nervous. And, you know, I was nervous for my first game on the radio with Brendan in Oklahoma City that October. But you go through 3 months, and it's as if you're taking on a whole new challenge when you know, fill in for those guys who I, you know, have watched and idolized, you know, over the years. And then you're working with, you know, arguably the greatest Knick of all time. Clyde, we were on the bus. It was the close of a long road trip out west, and it was the second of a back-to-back. So we had barely slept. We were in Phoenix, and I remember I was sitting on the right side of the bus, and he was on the left side across the aisle. Mm-hmm. And I sit down, the seat's open next to him. He says, Ed, come here. And I walk across, I sit next to him. He says, hey, man, you do your thing. I'll follow you. And to hear that from him was just this great moment where you felt like he let his guard down and said, I'm in this with you. You felt like you were on the same team. And that really helped put me at ease. Now, you could probably ask the guys on the crew, the funny moment was when we did the open, we did the rehearsal and Clyde went through it as normal. When we taped the open, live to tape, he did something different. And he said, as I introduced him and I said, Clyde, close the road trip. Knick's trying to end on a high note. He goes, where's Mike? Where's Kenny? Who are you? So he just has a way to put the right stamp on it. But, you know, working with him, yeah, I think there are many times you have to pinch yourself. But it's one of the great joys of the job has been getting to know Clyde and call him a friend, because he really is special. And he knows how much he means to people. And I think that comes across in how he treats them.
You know, you like you said about the Knicks before, about, you know, if they won, I really feel like, and I don't know if it is for you, but you walk in arenas and you walk into games and, you know, it's in a game, it's an arena or whatever. But I feel like, and I tell people this, that until you go to a Knicks game at Madison Square Garden, I feel like there's this buzz – that no matter what is always there. Did you find that?
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, there's some nights when the team's not playing well and the record isn't what you'd like it to be if you're a fan or somebody covering the team. You know, you walk in and it's 7:30 and all of a sudden you look out and I have this moment. I love to, when we stand and we carry the national anthem on the radio, I like to stand, take a breath and kind of look to the left and pan across and look to the right, just take a gander up at the stands and the upper reaches at the Garden, and the place is filled. And maybe it's fans from another country or diehards down below. You might have a fan who's seen their first NBA game. And this one game out of 41 means so much to somebody in this building. And I think you can never separate yourself from that. And there have been some tough years, there's no doubt about it. But, you know, the fans in New York are unlike any other. And this is the city's game, and this is their team. And through the hard seasons recently, that hasn't changed. And yeah, there are times where you pause and you say, it really is incredible. And it's something so strong to be a part of. I think about that almost every time I go on the air.
Hmm. Well, most of us played video games growing up. And yes. You become the voice of NBA Live 19. How cool was that?
Oh, it's like an out-of-body experience. I loved playing NBA Jam. Mm-hmm. That was my favorite. And you know what the other one was? I think it was NHL 93 or 94. Mm-hmm. And playing with the Rangers, you'd have either John Ogrodnik or Chris King coming down the left side, and they'd do that wraparound move.
Yeah.
Or the Penguins were incredible with Stevens, Lemieux, and Jagr.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I hadn't played in years, and EA Sports were auditioning a number of people, and they're based in Orlando. So I went down there for a day, and I was very honest. I said, it's so different from what I'm used to. This would be fun because it's so different. Mm-hmm. And just to be a part of it would be so surreal. And I think that, you know, you don't want to take yourself too seriously on a video game. Mm-hmm. And the guys down there, it's a great group. They also produce the Madden game on NFL. And to just be a part of that team, to work with Jay Williams and so many others was really something that was out of the box and different. But it is fun to pop in the game once in a while and play. Mm-hmm. You know, that's for sure.
How long was the process? How long did you record for? How many days were you there?
Yeah, I'd say I've gone down the last couple of springs. And, you know, once the NBA season came to an end, I went down a few times during the All-Star break and when there was another, you know, 1 or 2 day gap in the schedule. But for the most part, I'd fly down, say, on a Monday or Tuesday, take the first flight out of New York and stay for 2 or 3 days. We're not going wall to wall for 10 hours a day, just in terms of voice and performance levels. You want to stay fresh. Mm-hmm. But I would do that really the last couple of springs once a week for, you know, 2 days at a time. So it feels like it's a schlep and a long way to go. But as you know, when you get in a routine, even flying down to Orlando, you kind of in your head make it as if it's a stroll down the street. And it was a long weekly commute, but at the same time, you know, between Christian McLeod and Reggie Sammy, Jeff Villanueva, just the producers who I worked with the last couple of years, they make it a fun, creative, worthwhile experience every time we're down there.
So for you, you've called a lot of different sports. What do you find the most challenging?
Most challenging, I'll say baseball.
Yeah.
And I know you alluded to a couple of stops I had in the minors. I was in Burlington, North Carolina in 2007, and I did 2 summers in Billings, Montana. And since then, I've done a handful of games, you know, since, mostly off of monitors, but some college games on site. And I love the sport, and I love calling it, but you really have to do it every day. You need to be there, you know, 140 games in the minors, 162 in the major leagues, to really master the art of, number one, It might be the slowest pace of any sport, but when the ball's in play, there's no sport that's faster, where the action is so quick and there's so many nuances to tie a play up. So I think you're balancing that aspect of it with the storytelling, especially on the radio, mm-hmm. and especially solo. And I think, you know, if you listen to a major league broadcast, you don't hear a ton of byplay during an at-bat. In a lot of ways, whoever's on the mic for play-by-play might be doing most of that inning. Mm-hmm. But you go solo 9 innings a night, every night, it's the best breeding ground for an announcer. But I think in managing the storytelling and the pace of the action when the ball's in play is by far the hardest.
Do you have a favorite call or game that you've done?
Favorite call or game? A number of Knicks games, it's hard to pinpoint one of the last 2+ years mm-hmm. where the Garden was just rocking. I think if we're to take examples from this past year when they came back and they beat the Rockets, I think Mario Hezonja's block of LeBron James on St. Patrick's Day a couple mm-hmm. of years ago was really special. I think early in my career, there was a Manhattan Iona game I did in 2006. That was for the league title, which at the time I was 22, felt like I was calling the Super Bowl. It was a long time ago. But that was just because you're so invested.
Right.
The people, the fans, it's your first job, which for many is their first love. And that's what it was for me. So those are a few. I'll give you one more. I know we talked earlier about the New York Cosmos. They played a U.S. Open Cup match in 2015, and I did it with Shep and I think Mike Petke. I think we had a three-person booth, and it was against NYCFC out at Hofstra. 2 weeks earlier, the Cosmos had toured Cuba, and I made that trip, which was amazing. It was just this storybook season. They had Raul, the legend for Real Madrid, mm-hmm. on the team. And they were trailing by 2 goals, I think, in the 88th minute. And they scored 2 goals before the whistle to force a couple of extra time rounds. And then it went to a shootout. And Jimmy Maurer, the Cosmos goalie, made some incredible saves. I think it was 3-1 in kicks. They came back, tied it, and then won. And I know there were only 15,000 people there. It felt like there were 50,000. It might get, you know, because of the Cosmos and U.S. soccer and not playing in a league like the NASL at the time, it's one of those games that might get lost to history unless you were there. Mm-hmm. Like 20 years from now, I think many people might forget the Cosmos presence in the modern era. But for me, that was just an awesome game that I'll never forget.
That's awesome. Well, before I let you go, each episode I kind of, you know, support a small business. Is there a small business right now by you that you'd like to kind of mention who's been good to you or you'd like to support at this time?
Yeah, no, I appreciate you asking. Cafe Luca, not for Doncic, but Cafe Luca, they're on First Avenue up between 70th and 71st. Great guys, Bash Brothers, Mark and John Bash. Yeah, they are the Bash Brothers, which I'm sure they've heard one or two times in their lives, but they're a great group. I know they're doing the best with everything that's going on here, you know, during the pandemic, and want to give a shout out to those guys. It's a wonderful place, great for families, and has really become an institution here on the Upper East Side.
Awesome. Well, Ed, I appreciate your time, and enjoy that little one, and hopefully we'll be listening to you on the radio very soon calling a Knicks game.
Steve, thanks, man. I know I said at the top, but I was, you know, when you reached out, it meant a lot because you had so many great guests on. You're a Kenny Albert raves about you. You're a great teammate. I could say
he's on the payroll.
Fantastic. He is on the payroll, but you're a fantastic Twitter follower, and you know, I grateful to be on with you. Thank you.
I appreciate it, Ed. Thank you very much. Boy, Ed has called every sport under the sun. Incredible versatility for a sportscaster with so many great years ahead of him. Be on the lookout for the next episode of Mike Check on Sports. Take care. Brush your hair.